latest edition of IFLR's Closing Conditions podcast. I'm John Crabb, Managing Editor of IFLR and Practice Insight. For this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Kay Swinburne, Vice Chair of Financial Services at KPMG. Kay's had quite the career in the space. She was most recently appointed as Chair of the International Regulatory Strategy Group, a UK-based practitioner-led body that has tasked itself with an overall goal of achieving sustainable growth. Before joining KPMG, Kay was a member of the European Parliament, representing Wales for 10 years and serving as Vice Chair of the European Parliament's Economics and Monetary Affairs Committee. Kay was involved in shaping much of the regulatory landscape that IFLR and Practice Insight has reported on in the last decade or so, including MiFID II, EMIR, and the Capital Markets Union. As an MP, Kay was heavily involved in the Brexit negotiations, where insight into regulation and financial policy saw her play an influential role throughout the entire process until leaving Parliament in June 2019. I'm sure you'll agree we have plenty to talk about, so please enjoy the podcast. So thank you so much for joining me today, Kay. We spoke very briefly last week, and based on that alone, I'm in no doubt you have a lot of insight to offer our listeners. I'll start things off with a few questions about everyone's favourite topic, Brexit, although I do believe you take some issue with the way in which the UK's exit from the European Union is labelled these days.
I think since 2016, an awful lot has happened, and now we are where we are. We need to move past these labels, I think, just to talk about the future of a global financial centre, which is London, and the future of the Europeans' CMU, their Capital Markets Union, is a far more positive way of talking about this rather than a label of Brexit, which seems to have negative connotations for all sides.
You were heavily involved in Brexit negotiations during your time as an MEP. So what's your view now, 7 months on?
So I think we're in a position that I wouldn't have wanted to have been in. And indeed, I'm not sure anybody would have planned to be where we are now. I think everyone had hoped that the relationship between the UK and the EU 27 member states would actually be a lot more positive than it currently is. But given that we do have an agreement that has been concluded, so there is a trade cooperation agreement in place. And indeed, there are many new arrangements in place, and hopefully the memorandum of understanding will be signed fairly shortly and will be ratified by the Parliament in Brussels in order to actually make sure that our regulators, both sides for financial services, will continue an enhanced dialogue to make sure that what needs to happen with regards to communication and collaboration on both sides can and indeed does happen going forwards. So I'm very hopeful that there is some positive signs, but obviously we are in a difficult place with regards to other matters like equivalence decisions, where the EU has decided that it will only grant equivalence determinations in areas where it's in their interests to grant it. And so we're seeing that in things like clearing, they are granting temporary equivalence measures. But in certain areas like the share trading obligations or indeed the derivative trading obligations, those two equivalence determinations are not coming anytime soon. And so therefore, the two jurisdictions will inevitably, I think, go their own way rather than having that much closer relationship that was hoped for by market participants, certainly back in 2016-17.
From a regulatory perspective, would you say there have been any big surprises since the UK actually left the EU, or has it played out as was expected before the event?
I think we've had an unusual period with the pandemic, and so I think things have happened that I wouldn't necessarily have anticipated would have happened, and in particular from the EU side. So last December, when we saw the emergency pandemic rules come out, which effectively mitigated a number of the MiFID II rules, for example, those were a surprise to me because I didn't see quite how the pandemic really had an impact on those aspects. And therefore, I didn't see why they were being done outside of the formal review of MiFID II, for example. But outside of that, I'm not sure there are too many surprises. The good thing about financial regulation, of course, is that it is planned well in advance. It's consulted on, no matter whether that's the EU or indeed the UK. There's a formal process and it's very engaging with market participants. So surprises are things that we shouldn't see in financial regulation. Sometimes there's an interpretation that we don't expect, but it's very rare that we haven't had sight of it. So no, outside of those pandemic changes, which were labelled as pandemic measures, which I think were just MiFID competitiveness issues, I don't think there have been too many of those.
Now that the UK has the power to carve its own path, what do you consider to be its best course of action? Does that involve working independently of the EU and of equivalents, or closer together?
So I would expect the UK as a global financial centre, and indeed a leading global financial centre, to in some ways now be able to have a rule book that is suited to its wholesale markets and to its dominant position with regards to those wholesale market participants. So I would envisage that the markets maybe are more tailored going forwards in terms of the rule book. But I also don't envisage, given that MiFID II was such a very large piece of market infrastructure, I'm not envisaging wholesale changes. So I'm expecting anything that happens in the UK to be very much evidence-based. But given it's one country and not 28, as it was when most of these rules were written, I am expecting them to be able to move more quickly and to not have to make compromises potentially between other member states and other regulators, that they'll be able to use one data source and be happy and comfortable with what that data is telling them. I'm also, there's a slight note of caution with regards to the future financial framework in the UK. We obviously set up our regulators as they currently stand in the shadow of the European Supervisory Authorities. And so therefore, the scrutiny that used to happen of the rule book in the European Parliament and at the Council are no longer written into the UK's legislative programme. And so who actually now scrutinises the rule book that is going to land on the FCA and the PRA's lap? And so I think we've got quite a few changes potentially coming in terms of the way that the politicians interact with the legislation that the regulators are proposing, and indeed where HMT's role and the regulators starts and ends. So I think there's quite a few changes ahead of us. It's not going to be completely plain sailing because so many changes are inevitable. But I am hoping that whatever happens, the evidence-based and more principles-based rules will be apparent. And in that, I'd expect proportionate application of those rules, depending on the risk that's posed by the various entities, rather than just being complete black and white, you're either included or you're not included.
There has been much talk of the rise of the US as a financial services superpower as a direct result of the divorce. Do you see this happening, and what can be done to prevent it? Do you think anything needs to be done to prevent it?
So I think what we're seeing, and certainly have been seeing since January 1st, is that trading activity and post-trade activity has been finding new homes. And partly that's because the equivalence determination by the EU for UK-based entities hasn't been granted. So as I mentioned at the beginning, the share trading obligation and, more importantly, probably the derivative trading obligation was not granted. Equivalence. And so if you don't have that, then where do you do your trading? Do you actually move it to an area that is equivalent, which you already have your operations set up in, and which is the United States? Or do you actually move it potentially to the EU 27, somewhere within that jurisdiction? And of course, not all EU 27 countries' national competent authorities in financial services are actually acting in exactly the same way. So who do you pick? Where do you pick? And how do you make that selection? What would be most important? I think in the short term, many of the global firms thought it was easier to actually channel much of that trade to serve their EU clients through their US existing entity rather than setting up new ones. I'm not sure over the longer term that that is going to be the case. There are several things that could happen. One is that, you know, that equivalence decision could finally be granted, and therefore London will still potentially be a venue of choice. Or indeed, you may find that the US actually uses this opportunity really well and therefore maintains that edge that it currently has, where it's consolidating a lot of the trading and post-trade activity within its own entities. Or you may find that one or two of the EU venues become much more dominant. So, you know, whether it's Amsterdam or indeed Paris, it's a question of which one competes the hardest and succeeds to actually get some of that flow of activity through, and therefore the liquidity pool deep enough to actually warrant them becoming the center of choice. And so what the UK and what the US have always had is deep pools of liquidity, which is why they have been the venues of choice for global players. But if you end up developing a deep pool of alternative liquidity in one of those centres where they effectively take all of the EU's business and pool it into one location, you may find that one of them will become a very competitive centre too. But, you know, ultimately, global financial centres come and go. Global financial centres go from strength to weakness and vice versa. So I am hopeful that the UK will maintain a global financial status and that it will have one eye to competitiveness when it decides to change its rule book rather than change for change's sake. So whether it's the US, whether indeed it's one of the Asian markets that actually come up in preeminence, a lot of it's going to rely upon things like, you know, where are the capital requirements going to be? What are the specific rules you're going to apply on third country access? How are you potentially going to structure your markets to make them easy to access and to actually have a good, sensible, easy to understand and interpret rule book and a regulator who understands proportionality? I also think there's an awful lot more we can do with regards to the future digital capital markets. So who dominates now in the traditional markets may not be the same centre who dominates or several who participate in that dominance going forwards. So those who embrace some of the digital ledger technology, some of those who embrace the tokenization for raising funds may indeed be the biggest financial centres of the future, and they're not necessarily going to be in the West.
It hasn't yet become obvious which financial centres will become dominant, as you say. But what time frame do you expect this to become apparent? When will we have the answer, so to speak?
I think we've got a crossroads for several reasons, not just the UK now actually outside of the EU, but you've also got new pressures post-pandemic, where you are wanting to actually have a much more, as the EU calls it, strategic autonomy, where they don't want to be reliant upon other areas for what they consider to be key strategic activities, and financial services would be one of them. So the pandemic has played a part in changing things. I also think you've got changes in this digital agenda where you're seeing new players, new activity, new entities coming forwards that we couldn't have envisaged even a decade ago. So are we talking about a big change in the next 2 to 3 years? Probably only incremental step change. But I think once we get beyond that, the 5 year and beyond, I think there are some potential big changes out there. When we have CBDC, when we have alternative tokens, when we have other ways of doing post-trade processing, I genuinely think, you know, there will be some first mover advantage, and those who embrace innovation and technology and have the legislative framework that actually moves with that and allows that to flourish will end up being the more dominant centres. So post 5 years, but I wouldn't like to have a crystal ball any more than that.
What do you make of the Bitcoin announcement this week from Rishi Sunak?
I wouldn't use the terminology, to be fair, in that way, but I think it's really important that the Bank of England, who has been at the forefront of the global thinking of the central banking community, actually now makes public a lot of its thinking and a lot of its activity. So they have done a huge amount of work. And when I did the Khalifa review over the last 10 months, it's been very apparent that they have done a huge amount of thinking in this regard. And I think making it public and allowing people to see what they're thinking and what the future role for the Bank of England in that new coin-based technology is going to be really important. And I think, you know, they have credibility globally. When the Bank of England actually embraces something and actually says, listen, you know, we are behind innovation. We are looking at all the consequences. If this is something that's good for our economy and good for society, then we should be actually at the vanguard. So I'm actually really, really glad that they've come public with all the activity that they're doing. And certainly for me, putting new teams in place that allow them to take that forwards at pace is, I think, a really good sign that the UK is committed to future innovation. And indeed, for me, when you think about, you know, Big Bang, the first time round in the 1980s, it was about the first stages of electronification of the markets. The UK embraced it and actually put in place the legislation, some would say deregulation, but indeed it was legislation that allowed a broader number of market participants to actually be members of exchanges and to actually participate in the markets. So I think it's just right that the UK is now embracing what I would call that Big Bang 2.0, which is about embracing this new technology, embracing, you know, what those future coins may actually be, and that the Bank of England's at the heart of it. They were the first time round. I think it's only right that the second time round they're there too.
So let's move away from talk of Brexit, or whatever we should be calling it these days. What specific regulatory changes are taking up most of your time and your clients' time at the moment?
So I think I mentioned some of them in terms of the changes to the marketplace that were unexpected. So certainly the pandemic has actually put major pressures on most government spending and has had a major impact upon the economic, GDP of most countries around the globe. So capital requirements post-COVID are going to be really important. How do you take, for example, sources of long-term capital and put them to use for the good of society? So for me, Solvency II is going to be an important place to start. So Solvency II puts on deliberately some punitive charges on those insurance companies and long-term asset holders with regards to investments in certain private fields. I believe that making those capital charges less punitive and allow that capital to be put to work will actually be good for society and good for the investors themselves. So I think, you know, capital requirements is one that we really do need to look at in all its guises. Market structure is obviously a big issue. You know, with that digital agenda on the horizon, you are going to have to keep looking to your rule books to make sure that they're fit for purpose. But the really big one, I guess, is ESG. The way in which we have rethought the way financial services facilitates the change to a more environmentally and sustainable future, certainly a more carbon neutral future than the one that we would have envisaged even 5 years ago. So ESG for me and the role financial services are expected to play is taking up a very significant amount of my time. I don't think I have a client in FS who isn't impacted either by the EU rules on disclosure for funds and the way in which the companies they invest in are actually sort of impacting the environment or indeed impacting society as a whole and the governance that's packaged around that, or the way that banks are having to stress test their loan portfolios. All of these are very significant, and the EU deliberately put the financial services sector at the heart of these changes. They always believed that if you had the source of capital, were having to be more responsible and choose who got that money to fund what activities, then you're going to be able to facilitate change more quickly. And so I think, you know, the good thing for me is that financial services firms, both the banking, insurance and the asset management sector, and indeed private equity, are stepping up to the plate now and are really playing a proactive part in how to actually get companies to net zero, how they're helping fund transition, and the way in which you actually go through your supply chain to look for good social impact rather than actually just accepting what any company was doing historically. So I'm really excited and being kept very busy by those three things. So capital requirements, market structure, and ESG.
You mentioned MiFID already, but let's discuss it in more depth. From the beginning, you were involved in creating MiFID II, and you have defended it since. As time goes on, it appears the UK and the EU are going to end up with different versions of the rule in some way. What do you make of MiFID II now and the potential divergence we're seeing? Is this down to cost and implementation charges, or is it something bigger than that?
So for me, I mean, I was involved in MiFID II from the very outset and wrote the Parliament's own initiative report that predated MiFID II. But for me, it was always the very, very large file that I always felt and indeed argued with Michel Barnier, the then EU commissioner, that this should have been several files rather than one big piece of legislation. And in part, the reason I argued that was because when it gets so big and so unwieldy, you never agree with all of the different bits of it, but you end up defending the indefensible. So MiFID II was the biggest political compromise. And the reason Michel Barnier wanted it as one dossier was because he felt the compromises would be less, that you'd have less influence of the three big member states, UK, Germany and France, if you did it as one big package rather than doing them individually as different pieces. So MiFID was always a big experiment. It was the biggest piece of legislation ever tried to be crafted. There was a lot of things in there that were aspirational in terms of changing market behavior, but you didn't really know when you were putting these pieces of legislation and individual articles together, you didn't really know what the impact was going to be on the ground in the financial markets day to day. And 3 years on, post-implementation, there was always an inbuilt review into that piece of legislation, specifically to address that point, that, you know, much of this was the data wasn't available, thresholds were put in without data sources, so you had to recalibrate at some point, and 3 years was where we thought that needed to happen. Because of the pandemic, it's been delayed by a year, so MiFID III is not going to appear until the autumn this year when it would have been expected last year. But the reality is that it needs to be changed. You know, we now have data. We know what works, what doesn't work, both in the EU and in the UK. And there will be differences in interpretation. So the data that the FCA has may actually draw certain conclusions. The data that other regulators across Europe have may actually bring them to a different conclusion. But of course, the difference at the moment is that any changes going through the UK system are subject to only one member state's political oversight, and they therefore have a government with a fairly significant majority. So it's unlikely the politicians are going to make major changes to what the regulators and Treasury actually come up with as solutions. Whereas in the European system, as I well know, having been part of it for 10 years, it's the co-legislators, once that piece of regulation is drafted, the changes are drafted by the Commission, it's the co-legislators, the European Parliament's Econ Committee, in this case, and the Council financial attachés, who will go to work on that file. So it will be highly politicised in the way that MiFID II was, and I'm told MiFID, the original MiFID I, was as well. So those political compromises will mean that things will happen and things will change that maybe wouldn't have been what the regulators themselves would have wanted. So the process will be different, the timelines will be different, and the outcome, I would hope the actual principles won't be too different because the same market participants lobby both sides. But the reality is, I think the detail will inevitably be different. So long as the outcome is in line and they're trying to achieve the same end goal, maybe by slightly different means, that shouldn't have any lasting negative impact on any future equivalence decisions. But the reality, of course, is that, you know, the changes could get significant, particularly given there's a new parliament. Very few of the original politicians who worked on MiFID II are now still in place. And so they will all have a very different lens to the one that we would have had in 2014 when that file was originally passed. So things are different, processes are different. One will be regulator and treasury led, very much based on evidence, and the other will have a bigger political influence and compromise between 27 countries. So inevitably, slight differences.
Are there any parts of MiFID II you wouldn't mind seeing the back of in the UK?
So I think for me, there are a few things here. One is that the UK never had an issue with diversity of trading venues. And indeed, you could say they would say that because of when they served the EU as the EU's global financial centre, they had almost all of the venues exclusively based, the non-exchange ones in the UK. So almost all the MTFs, OTFs, all were registered and ran their operations from the UK. So they always supported that diversity in venue choice and supported investors and traders to actually choose the venue that suited them for the particular trade they were making. The EU felt slightly differently and always felt that there was a benefit in trading on a lit venue over dark trading. and that they argued fairly vociferously for that to be the case, and indeed put in things like the trading volume caps. So the double volume cap of 4% and 8% were because they felt they wanted to restrict the amount of trading that could be done in the dark on any particular venue. The UK never supported that. So I suspect we're going to end up with a slight difference in terms of that diversity of venue and where trading might happen. And indeed, systematic internalizers, the SIs, were little used in MiFID I, have suddenly become very prominent after MiFID II, particularly because the broker crossing networks were closed down. And so on that basis, the SIs have risen in prominence. Many of my former colleagues in Brussels are really unhappy about this and actually believe that the SIs are not serving the purpose that they would like them to, and that they would prefer those to be fully transparent, open, public venues. And so there is a big, I think, philosophical divide between lit versus dark trading. And I think that's where we're going to see the biggest changes and differences emerge between the UK and the EU. They were always there, but the UK had to participate in compromises when it was within. It doesn't have to participate in those compromises now that it's outside.
So you recently took on the role of chair of the International Regulatory Strategy Group, an independent body that addressed regulatory developments in the UK. What are your main intentions with the role of an intermediary?
So for me, it's been a huge honour to be asked by the industry to take this chairmanship of the IRSG up. And as the name suggests, it's actually an international regulatory strategy group. So it doesn't just purely look at the UK's regulatory framework. It indeed has standing committees that actually look at the EU regulatory framework and indeed global coherence. So there are sort of, at its heart, it has an outward-looking agenda rather than just internal. But for me, it really is an opportunity to shape that regulatory agenda and to make it possible that the market participants, whether they be the banks, the dealers, the buy side, the investors themselves or the issuers, that we actually take all of their soundings and allow a voice of the industry to come through. There is nothing worse than regulation being made in a vacuum. Regulators don't have the same experience, by and large, that those working in the markets do. So for me, it's important to have that voice, and the IRSG does that, but they do it in a thorough, competent way where they look at all of the evidence, gather it, and then actually come to draw some conclusions together. So I'm really proud of the caliber of the work that comes out, particularly in the reports that the IRSG produce. And for me, it's an opportunity to really shape the global agenda, where global coherence is a really important thing for market participants. And we can actually try and shape that agenda, which is what we're going to try and do, certainly on ESG and data and the future regulatory frameworks and cooperation around the globe. So we have big aspirations. So I'm hoping that under my chairmanship that those aspirations will be delivered.
You mentioned it earlier in our discussion, but another issue that has risen to prominence in the last few years is the ongoing development of the Capital Markets Union and the Banking Union in the EU, as well as the UK's involvement in both. What do you make of the progress of the two, and how important is it that those involved keep pushing for those two projects to be completed?
So it's really interesting when you think about the banking union project was as a direct result of the financial crisis and in particular the Eurozone crises that followed. And so it was an opportunity for the Commission to put forwards a proposal that broke the direct link between the banking sector in a particular country and the ability of their governments to effectively intervene in order to actually persuade them to fund certain activities during a crisis. And so the banking union project, I don't believe ever would have got off the ground had we not had the financial crisis and then the subsequent Eurozone crises. So for me, banking union was a necessity. It actually happened in such a way that it was equitable for all countries involved. It obviously involved the Eurozone banks, and then anybody else as a member state could opt into the system if they so choose to do so. And it set up a single supervisory mechanism. So that SSM, a single regulator that oversees and supervises what's taking place. those are really important things when you've got, you know, a union that you really do within the Eurozone need to have a coherent strategy that's not doing damage to one another. Banking union, I think, will go from strength to strength. And I think, you know, the SSM has proven its worth and is certainly now that you've got a large number of global banks have moved their operations out of the UK, you know, because of the lack of passport anymore, have moved into an EU venue and now have a subsidiary authorised and regulated by the SSM, I think it's going to even gain greater coherence and greater prominence as the years go on. CMU is slightly different. CMU wasn't out of the crisis. CMU was a proposal that was put forward by the Juncker Commission. And indeed, you know, President Juncker at the time was very much a former finance minister and prime minister of a financially savvy member state in Luxembourg. So Juncker actually saw that the US had sources of capital that the EU did not. And so 80% of the EU's funding for all companies comes from bank lending, that over-reliance on the banking sector vis-a-vis the US, where 80% comes from the capital markets. So a complete role reversal to the way that Europe was vulnerable to the banks. So CMU, launched, of course, by a UK commissioner, was launched using London and the global financial centre that was London as being the hub and spoke. So CMU inevitably, post the 2016 decision for the UK to leave, has been a really big thing. And so for me, you know, CMU now means that you can use this as an opportunity for the 27 countries to now have one coherent capital market. But it's not only about having one single rule book. For me, it needs to go further. It needs to have a full regulatory coherence. And that means that investors shouldn't be aware of different legal systems for their investments across the union. So I would like to see CMU take on the barriers of withholding tax, take on and break down the barriers with regards to the corporate law in each member state with regards to holdings in various securities. There are things that they could do in securities law that would really make the EU have a true CMU. And until they address them, I think it's always going to be 27 capital markets working closer and closer together rather than a true union. So you need that legal harmonization to have a true union. And that needs them to be brave to take away some of the corporate law in each of the member states in order to allow the EU law to have dominance.
So from a personal perspective, how has it been transitioning from working at a bank to in government to private counsel? Have you found there have been any real difficulties with these moves, or have they complemented each other?
Well, the interesting thing for me is that the players seem to stay the same. And so my network is the same as it had been when I was a banker, when I then became a member of the Econ committee, and then now back in an advisory role. The players are all the same. The role I'm playing is slightly different. But for me, it's being able to leverage that network, being able to take the information that I'm able to gather and then interpret it for various people because of the roles I've played. And I'm really enjoying it right now, being able to interpret what my regulators are doing around the globe, being able to interpret what the politicians are likely or unlikely to do or say, and be able to translate that for my C-suite clients is an exciting thing. So I'm actually, I think, very privileged to have worked in the financial services sector and to actually have been part of that legislative program and now to be able to help shape it from the other side. So it's been a bit of a continuum rather than complete different career paths.
My final question, which it would be remiss of me not to ask, but I think I already know the answer to, would you ever consider re-entering UK politics?
The very short answer is no. I wouldn't be doing any more political, direct public service. But on the other hand, you know, there are many, many ways of influencing policy and the outcomes. And so for me, this is just the next chapter of being able to look at things from a slightly different perspective, from a different lens, and be able to help some of those now in a position to write the legislation and to write the rule book. So I'm hoping that some of the years of experience that I've had are actually going to be useful to others as I feed back into the system. And in particular, the IRSG chair, I think, gives me that platform to be able to help facilitate some of the positive outcomes I hope that there will be, both in the UK, the EU, and indeed globally, when it comes to things like ESG standards.
Excellent. Thank you very much for your time today, Kay. That was very insightful, as expected, and I'm sure everyone very much enjoyed listening. Thank you so much, and speak soon.
A pleasure. Thank you, John.